Hi, fellow geochemists and geochemistry enthusiasts. Welcome to Geochemistry, the only podcast for people who love geochemistry with a side of tea. Our mission is to inspire aspiring geochemists and to introduce our listeners to niche geochemistry topics. I'm your host, Sam Scher, and this month we're talking with the former team at IO Global, who helped shape the way geochemistry was interpreted and implemented at exploration and mines around the world. We have a very diverse listenership at Geochemistry. So before we start introducing our guests, I would ask Dave Lowy, the former managing director at IO Global, to introduce us to what IO Global was and to explain a bit of its legacy, apart from introducing our other guests.
Sam and team, and thanks for setting up this podcast. Great idea. I've not seen this collection of reprobates in one spot for a very, very long time. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. IO Global was born out of a partnership between myself and Steve Winter. I remember to this day sitting in Vancouver, actually, where I lived at the time, and Steve Winter, whom I knew from Pasmigo, who was the chief, or was he the principal computing scientist, geoscientist, I think, when we had roles that sounded like that. He came over to visit me in Vancouver. At the time, I was working for Anglo, but we worked together at Pasmigo, and we were just having a drink in the kitchen or something, and he said, "You should come and join this little company that I've set up called IO Digital at the time." So it was purely data management focused, putting data in the cloud. Before there was a cloud, it was actually two servers in a suburb of Melbourne called Elsternwick. Because they wanted to expand the remit of the company. And of course, things like OGAS hadn't even been dreamt up at that point, but it was really to start up the consultancy part of the business. So I fell in a perfectly good career, long career job at Anglo American, for those guys that are listening, and went and joined Steve and left Vancouver, which for those listening in Vancouver was not such a great thing to do, and moved to Perth. Every time I go back and visit Vancouver and look at it out of the airplane coming to land, I think, oh my God, why in the hell did I ever leave this place? But anyway, such is life, as Ned Kelly said before he was hung in the gallows. So yeah, well, you were digressing already, so we haven't bloody started yet.
A little bit. Yeah, fine.
But anyway, so we had the geological data management. When I joined, we started up the geochemical consulting, of course, and steadily built that team up. First victim on this in this group was Mike Whitbread, actually. And we'll come back to Mike at the end of the show, I hope, about his nickname. But Mike was the first victim to start that up, which was great. I was one of his co-supervisors for his PhD at the time. And then shortly thereafter, we got offered a very, very, very early, very basic, very shit version of GAS, it was called, not IOGAS then, to see if we were interested in it. Eventually we bought the IP for that and then started building it out to something that was a nice, decent product. And as it continues to this day, so IO Global to cut down, went for, I don't know, 10, 12 years, something like that. Steadily built up the team, including the office in Vancouver and some of the people on this call as well. The IO GAS team steadily built up as well. But by the end of the day, when we finally exited the company or sold it to Index, did geochemical and geometallurgical consulting. That's the important thing as well. We do still a lot of geomet. IO GAS was up and running as a standalone product, well known in the industry. Our geologic data management, I don't know, Michelle, remember we probably had 40 odd exploration companies sitting in that system. And the thing we forget now, which is probably worth reflecting on, is we did a lot of training. So the IO Global training, 3, 4, 5, 7 day long, really intensive training sessions on all aspects of geochemistry and geometallurgy and data interpretation. At the end of it, almost a philosophy of how you look at data and think about it. And I think that's a hole we left in the industry, actually. I don't see that it's been replaced very well or very adequately since then. And apart from some stalwarts that are out there still doing the thing by the consulting work, well, not even Pim doesn't really do that anymore, but people like Suggs and others, there's a bit of a gap left, and we see it now. I see it talking to people in the industry about what they do and how they go about things. And I think, oh my God, we left a void. And I don't think that's actually a very good thing. But no, I'm not going to go back and fill it either, Sam. That's for someone. That's for the younger people.
Somebody young, right? Someone young.
That's for someone younger to come in now that's got the burning ambition to do that.
But perhaps you would be on the advisory board, say, of a company such as that.
Oh, yes, it's entirely possible, Sam, actually.
Okay, so that could be a possibility.
Okay.
So never say never.
Gin and tonic and red wine and just handing out advice to heads we're doing.
There you go. The spirit. So anyway, thank you very much for that. And for our listeners too, I'm a little bit, but not much, but like slightly younger than some of these people on the call. And I remember when I would go to PDAC as a student or to Roundup, these guys would be all over the place. And it was just kind of the goal, right? It was like, oh my goodness, if I could work for somebody like this. I mean, they had to go and get bought before I could be like, here's my application. But that was a bit of the dream, anybody that was interested in exploration or mining style geochemistry. So it is a void. And anybody out there that's thinking of filling it, we got at least one person for your advisory board. So now that we've introduced people to what IO Global is, let's talk to all of the ex-consultants from IO Global here that we have on the call, just to get a little brief intro to who they are before we then bring you into what we're going to do here for this episode. So who wants to start? Anybody can start. And then maybe just keep going.
You're the oldest, Mike. Well, not in terms of age, definitely not. But all right, well, Mike Redbread, I started out as a baby geologist in Pasminco and got tired of looking at zinc numbers on a fax. So I thought there must be a better way. So I did a PhD and converted across and was in IO for a while and eventually went back into industry. And now I work for Rio Tinto Exploration. I'm allowed to say that on this podcast, I think, without getting shot. But I've ducked and weaved a little bit around the industry, but stayed as a geochemist since converting across through a PhD. And Pasminco paid for my PhD and then went broke. So I got made redundant while I was studying, which was great. It's a good way to do it. Anyway, there you go.
Love it.
Mike has the world record for the geochemist who's worked for the most companies, I think. Okay. And remained a geochemist. There you go.
Wow. Okay. Start making our own record book. I think right now I see a pattern here because I'm in this viewer mode and everything. I'm going to go around counterclockwise as to what I can see. So Heidi, would you like to introduce yourself next?
Yeah, sure. Hello, everybody. Heidi Pass. Yeah, looking back, I was doing a chemistry undergraduate degree in Canada, and I took geology as an elective and immediately fell in love with it. And so I guess the combination of geology and chemistry started quite early for me in my undergraduate degree. And then skipping forward, came to the University of Tasmania to do my PhD. And yeah, I had an interview with Dave when he was at Anglo, soon as you mentioned that, Dave, before I left Vancouver myself, which I also lament. But yeah, you know, doing it rough here on the shores of Perth. And wasn't successful in that job application, but came back, circled around to Dave after I finished my PhD when I was looking for some geochemistry work. And you know how they say you'll do something for a little while. And so that was, I think, almost 6 years with IO Global directly after my PhD and with the team here, which was a really exciting cornerstone of my career. And we worked on projects all over the world. And as Dave mentioned, we did heaps of training and often just thrown into the deep end, which was always an adventure. And now have combined the geology, the chemistry, and with mining tech and working as a chief geoscientist and chief product officer for OreXplore Technologies, which I think is pretty exciting and interesting, lots of interesting developments about where the industry is going, but I'll talk about that later. That's me.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about that later. All right, Dave, I see you next.
Hey, I've been talking already.
Yeah, I know. Just like a sentence. My name is Dave. Bye. Like,
Now, after selling IO, I went into MDEX, to MDEX. I'm still with MDEX. I'm the chief geoscientist there. Haven't actually done any true geochemistry for quite a while now. but certainly been involved in the development of measurement technologies, and ironically, most of it being geophysically based and various other things. But I still have my fingers in the pie, so to speak, with the IOGAS team. They're all, one thing that's interesting to people listening would be the IOGAS team as it was in IOGlobal days is still exactly the same IOGAS team now in IMDEX, with the addition of one or two other people. But that's it. That crew is still together. And I think you, the users of GAS, will see that when they use the product.
Michelle?
Leading Putra.
Leading Putra. So I was reflecting, I started being a geochemist at least four times, I think, and then I backlined a lot. So obviously did geochemistry at university and took a job with Western Mining as a graduate, as a geochemist, and then strayed and turned into the dreaded geochemist / geologist, and then reformed and went to university and did a PhD in hydrogeochemistry, and then backslid back into exploration management, working for BHP, and then joined IO to run this band of geochemical reprobates, which I think is still officially the most fun and rewarding job I've ever had. And then backslid again within IO and have never recovered from that particular backslide. So chief of strategy at IMDEX these days, and like Dave, even more extremely than Dave, I suspect. I definitely don't think I can call myself a geochemist anymore.
It's what's in your heart, I think, at this point.
In my heart.
This podcast is about heart. Speaking of heart, it's him.
Yeah.
Never leaves you.
Right, I'm Max.
Yeah.
Right, I'm Pim McGiffin. I'm in Vancouver at the moment. I love living here, but I didn't grow up here. I grew up in the Netherlands and did my undergrad and master's in UTF. And when I was finishing up my master's in mineral exploration, I was looking for work, and then we had a visit from Anglo-American, there's a common thread here, from London. We made sure to get them out to the bar late enough that they missed their flight back to London next day. So that eventually landed me a job in Vancouver, which I started in 2005. And after a year and a half of that, they said, we couldn't renew your visa, but we'll sponsor your PhD at Queen's. So I thought, well, before I get used to making money, I'll better go back to school now. So I did that. And of course, similar to what Mike was describing, when by the time I was writing up, Anglo was letting everybody go, and they did not have any further funding for me. Well, just enough to let me write up, but that was the end. They pulled out of Queens, and they didn't have a job for me. But luckily, in Exploration 07, remember those 10-year anniversary conferences you used to have? I met Dave in Toronto, and he said, oh, I've heard about you. I said, well, I've heard about you too. John Barr found that very funny. Anyway, fast forward, I'm wrapping up and I want to go back to Vancouver because, you know, Queens is a lot of fun for 2 weeks. I did have a lot of fun in Kingston actually, but I didn't want to stay there. So then David just opened an office with Dennis and Britt here in Vancouver. And I said, hey, I see you're taking over the world of exploration geochemistry. So, and he said, yep, write up, get it done and come join us. So that's how I ended up in 2011, Roundup 2011, or started with IOGlobal. And that was a lot of fun. In the first 2 years, I learned more than I ever learned throughout my formal geology training, as Heidi said, by being thrown in the deep end. And had a lot of fun, learned a lot. Then IMDEX took over. And then eventually, because of several layers of management, I was more sort of a logistics manager of XRF shipments, which I did not enjoy as much as consulting. So I ended up as an independent consultant again, and then got to work a little bit with CSA Global. Now, when they got taken over by ERM, I saw an opportunity to work with environmental people and water people and people who think about supply chains and sustainability, and I joined that group since. So now I'm with them, still in Vancouver, but sort of working the system from the inside, and yeah, really happy to be part of this IO family still. It's great to be in this reunion. Thanks for organizing.
Love this. So even though I can't see him, Des, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Des Fresco. I'm sort of the odd person out here because I'm not a geochemist. Never have been, never will be, and no aspirations to be. I joined IOGlobal from my previous job with a company called Mincom, and we were working on a now defunct product called QA Reporter. We're trying to, once again, take over the world with, we're doing QA the right way. It didn't ever really take off that much, and I don't think anyone's still doing it properly. It's more it's a pity, but I worked with IO Global for quite some time, and then when it got taken over by MDEX, got moved into there, and then I think I'm one of the first people that's actually retired out of the IO Global community. So,
oops, that was a mistake.
Sorry?
No worries. Yes.
I think I was the oldest person within the group, and yeah, probably it shows. I retired about three or four years ago, and still do a little bit of consulting, but try not to do too much because I don't like it to interfere with my leisure time. So,
collaboration. I love that.
Can I just add a little bit to what Des is saying? Around what he did for IO was, in a bunch of geochemists, having an actual analytical chemist who really understood what goes on in labs was unbelievably invaluable, actually, which took us down that QA reporting route and got us into laboratory auditing. And he basically kept us honest and factual when we were talking about what the hell goes on in labs. So again, I think there's another hole where I get rung up. I reckon I get a call every couple of months, someone asking, do you know anyone that can go and do a lab audit for us? I said, well, I know Des, but I think he's retired. And that's the end of the conversation.
Yeah. At the moment, I've still done a few lab audits. I think the last one I really did was for John Barr, but for Intertech in Perth.
But,
Hashtag
Anglo. Oh, that's yep. It's like when you hashtag something, like how the kids say it, it just means it's a topic trending. So Anglo's also been how Pim got laid off before even starting, and maybe others in this conversation. Anglo's now kind of going around and doing it again. So anyway,
RIP. But but every now and again, I'll still do a lab audit, but that'll be after I can walk again. But,
okay. What an intro.
Sorry.
So Steve, would you like to introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Steve Sugden. I'm really an exploration geologist, just what I probably half my career has been in exploration geology, but always had an interest in geochemistry. And about 2006, I had a midlife crisis on all fronts. And I suppose met Dave at a conference a couple of years before, and he was looking for a geochemist, and managed to persuade him, and he took a punt on somebody without a PhD who'd never worked in geochemistry but had a lot of industry experience as a consultant and a geochemist. And that worked out well, I think, for all concerned. Then, I suppose, after IMDEX trashed the consulting group.
No bitterness there.
It was a lost opportunity. It was an opportunity that probably didn't fit the IMDEX model, and they didn't know what to do with it. I segued back into actually structural geology with the IQ logger tool. I think Michelle's words were, you're the only person that's ever logged drill core structurally, so you're it. Then I suppose ended up, unlike Des, I copped the bullet one day and decided to go out on my own with the view to sort of limbo dancing through to when I could get my super in 9 months' time. And that didn't work. And I'm working as an independent consultant based out of Perth, and I'm flat out full-time busy now, which I never expected to be. So yeah, all things geochemistry, regolith mapping, and a little bit of structural core logging on the side.
I love this. Anyway, last but certainly not least, Putra, please.
Thanks, man.
This is a therapy session, as we've seen. So whatever you need,
Putra, come on. Bring it on. You can do this.
So I did my undergrad in land surveying and geology, actually. I wanted to be a land surveyor. How funny was that? And so I got the opportunity to do a master's in either geochemistry or structural geology. So I was leaning more towards structural geology, actually, but University of Melbourne, because I'm wearing the sweater now, they didn't have a supervisor who wanted to supervise the structural geology thesis. So I did it at Prominent Hill for OZ Minerals, doing exploration geochem. And I met Dave. I met Dave Lowy at the Prominent Hill site. And then I went to Perth one day, just helping him out on some stuff. And about a year later, just about a week before I graduated, Dave sent me an email asking, I'm going to be in Melbourne next week. Would you like to come down and have a chat? And I did. And I remember going to the old IO Global office on Collins Street. And I remember Dave there with his two kids. They were like so small then, and they're all, they're so tall now. Anyway, but then Dave told me, how would you like to help make IO gas diagrams for me? And I was like, yeah, sure. Because that's basically all I did for my thesis. So I ended up staying since then. And I've been wearing so many hats since I joined IO Global and then IMDEX. I've done basically everything under the sun that has to do with selling or making IO gas, and everything to do from being the product manager for IO gas, which is what I do now. Just basically setting the strategic direction and making sure it gets to the market and making everyone happy with the product, but also doing things like support, customer care, training, better consulting, just everything under the sun that has to do with IO gas, really. But I love it because I get to do this, just keeping in mind that IO gas is what took me here in the first place, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. I think, Sam, I think Pooch is underselling his skills with IO gas.
He is, because he deals with me all the time. Whenever I have a problem, I think right to him. But go ahead, Dave.
IO gas is a very complex piece of kit now. It does many, many, many things. I think Pooch is probably the only person walking the planet that knows every nook and cranny in IO gas and now. So he is the new repository of IO gas knowledge and wisdom and advice.
Yeah, so anybody can look it up on LinkedIn and then email him.
That's right. That's right. For his sins, that's what he is now.
Okay, I appreciate this introduction, guys. I think it was a little bit more therapy as well, which I think is very interesting. I've never had a therapy session before. I don't think I was particularly good at it, but I'm glad to have been here for you. But I think our listeners will love it. So thank you for the intros. But I want to bring us to the next section of geochemistry, and that is, of course, the T. We wouldn't be geochemistry if there was no T. For any of those that might not know, and we have a few people on this call that perhaps, later in life or just not American maybe, but T is American slang for gossip. It's nothing that has to be harmful, but it's still, we want to know what the dirt is. And maybe another host might be intimidated by trying to rein in eight people rather, like how to handle it in such a segment. But I love drama. I love tea. I love the gossip, and I want all of it. So I'm sure this is going to spiral, but in a very good way. Before we started recording, Dave has been talking to me since SCG in London about how he's going to start off stories here. So maybe, again, I'll leave it to you, Dave, or if somebody wants to steal the show here, let's just see. Kettle's hot, time to spill.
I do want to open this up, actually, and throw Mike Whitbread under us to start with. I want him to explain to all of the listeners how he got his nickname of Huge.
I was so afraid for this, but you know what? If Mike's going to explain it himself, I'll just let it happen.
This may backfire, Dave. This may backfire.
Yeah, this, after that disgraceful podcast with Dave a little while ago where this came up, I had all these unsolicited bits coming through LinkedIn asking about where this name Huge come from. And of course, it's a combination of something quite innocent mixing with Dave's perverted mind, right? So it's really the only way to describe how that comes out. And it's really around a handle. It's my handle, Sam. That's what it's come from. And it's my internet handle. So my initials are M-A-W. And so, which is more M-A-W. And so I had an online gaming handle of gaping_more, which Dave has converted to just calling it Huge something or other, which we're no longer allowed to say in polite company. So for a long time, he just called me Huge. And that's where it comes from.
Because he shortened it for you, because to say like multiple syllables would be too much
Oh, the second part of the second part of that term is not really mentionable, because I don't know if you've noticed that Dave does have borderline Tourette's, and so he does occasionally use a couple of slanderous words. And
I don't think borderline might.
So I do have a fond recollection of a call with a client, actually,
I think I was on that one, Mike.
And we were getting the brief on what they were after, and Dave was promising everything, and that we hadn't actually worked out how to do yet, which is pretty normal when you're a consultant.
Pretty normal. It's completely
expect
normal.
Expect yourself to be able to do it. Yeah. And he may have forgotten that
the client was on the phone.
The microphone hadn't been turned off when he was referring to our client in less than clamorous terms by the end of the call. So did you want to elaborate on that one, Dave, at all?
No, not really, Mike. I'm woke now. Don't know.
Always woke. Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
Anyway,
I think that might have been more than once. Which one was it?
There were two that I'm aware of, one that I was in, and then one not long after I'd left that people rang me up afterwards just to tell me about because it was so good. So anyway, but I'll just note share that. Got to get you back.
Oh, that's good.
Okay. Good. So we have some infighting here. I love this. So it's kind of like a little bit like couples therapy right now. So... All right. So that wasn't too far off the mark of what I thought you were implying by huge, but yeah. Okay. Any other kind of gossip? So we have Dave's inappropriateness generally, but now he's woke, which is important in 2023. And I respect that. We're here for that.
Occasional slip still happens.
I feel like I'm always so popular in the mining industry because of my like quote occasional slips. So, I mean, yeah. We're all there.
I thought Heidi might want to raise the drinking rules that we had in IO Global.
Oh my goodness.
Now, I think Michelle used to beat all of the ladies that worked in IO that they, if they were out with me, they could only have one drink for every two of mine, not to go one for one.
I do remember that actually in the very beginning. Michelle had a word of advice. I think that was in my... Yeah, when I had just come to Perth for that week, flown out from the East Coast just to get a feel for everyone and say good day and whatnot, we were going to go out for drinks. And there was that very astute advice about not to match, definitely. And that's still good advice, I think, unless, you know, I think Sam maybe has been able to top your liver there, Dave. But I do remember one time in Adelaide helping you into a cab one late night. I'm feeling a little bit pod shy, I guess, at the moment. Yeah, because there's definitely more to that story. But there was in other industries as well, right? We'd have the Friday afternoon drinks, Friday afternoon red wine. And then there was also a number of unwritten rules because there was the Friday afternoon. But then there was after we'd do these big, you mentioned, Dave, these big intensive 5-day, 3-day training courses, right? And then I remember... Somewhat fuzzily, the team would get together at the end of each day or the end of the second day and have a drinks. But by the end of the week, the team was together and we were all completely emotionally, spiritually, physically numb. And it was, our livers also got numb, I think, at the end of that week. So like, there was a bit of a ritual with that as well. I don't know. Am I missing any other drinking rules, explicit or otherwise, team?
It's not just for the ladies, Heidi. That was a rule that is known in our household as the Anglo drinking rule. Because I consulted briefly for Dave while he was ensconced in there. And I came home going, I'm going to die if I keep up with these people. It was called your Anglo skills, was being able to not die, but somehow still be at the table and conversing with people.
Learning to drink with professionals.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
I still
induct people into Index with the Dave rule, by the way. A large portion of the world is aware of the 1-for-2 ratio.
So when I met Mike for the first time in person in 2011 in Finland, He had moved on to BHP already, which included he could not buy us drink and we could not buy him drinks. But he did tell us that while Britt and I were there as part of IO Global, and he said, here's a strategy to keep up with Dave. He says, you just drink Guinness. He says, because Guinness is the only drink that you can just nurse. You don't need to down it. And you can just have one glass of Guinness while Dave polishes off a bottle of red. So in that sense, he gave us some advice on how to handle the drinking capacities. Thanks for that, Mike. Help me survive.
I feel like this is Go ahead, Dave, please.
But we're missing Brit on this call.
We are missing Brit on this call.
She's in Iceland.
This is Iceland. Did you know that?
She's in Iceland. Yeah.
Well, on the crazy stakes, Brit's right up there with me. So it was in those days.
I worked with Brit. I'm aware. The girl does a great job. She's just impressive and she keeps herself up straight. It's great.
And in fact, Fred got on the call and Fred is the one who never goes home. Right? Doesn't matter.
Sometimes he's lucky to get home.
Strong, silent type, isn't he? Is he going to watch out, Fred?
I feel like to anybody listening there that has the aspirations of creating the next IO Global, this is how you deal with a family. You figure out what everybody's drinking capacity is and how to fix the ratios. And it's not too different from Geochem, and we do all these stats. Somebody could really build this out and then figure out, you have your far outlier, your Dave. Maybe your Brit is just, she's an outlier, but then everybody else, you figure out what the median is perhaps. And I don't know.
Yeah, you've got to level your drinks accordingly, according to capacity. So, you know, that's how we approach it. Just like to say for the young kiddies that might be listening in, you don't have to be a drinking fiend to be a geochemist, but it helps. it is a skill, right, to be able to get to talk to people while they're more relaxed. And that's where a lot of work comes from. You know, people relax, let their guard down a little bit, and they'll often talk to you about their problems that you go, well, we can help with that. And then 2 years later, you'll get a gig out of them. It's usually quite a delay, but it's an essential part of consulting is drinking with people.
Yeah. It's like you get it in the back part of their brain and they just kind of call on you one day and they're like, oh yeah, well, you know, actually Sam or Mike or Pim or whoever can do this. And, you know, you planted that seed and you just let it fester for years. It's beautiful. No, it's a great piece of advice. And who would have thought out of a conversation about drinking and about things or people that are huge that we would get such great, beautiful advice. So that said, I think that this has been a great tea session. Again, I think more therapy. I love that. And I'm going to introduce us now to our last segment, which is where we're going to talk about the past, present, and future of geochemistry. So this episode, as you'll notice, is coming around on the holiday time. So I figured why not go with a little bit, not that I like Charles Dickens, it's not my most favorite author or anything, but Christmas Carol, that's pretty iconic. I think talking with that spirit then, talking about geochem in this way, I think would be really interesting, especially with just, if you think about everybody that we have the call now, the breadth of where people are situated, whether they're working in a technology company or whether they're working in a big mining company or doing some consulting. We have a lot of people, a lot of age ranges where we could actually get some pretty interesting insight. That said, one thing I'll say is that because now that we have these 8 guests, it just required a little bit of an adaptation of things. Not everybody's going to be interacting on every single question that I'm going to pose here. So for this episode, we're going to have the 3 modules looking at geochemistry's past, present, and future. Each module is going to be championed by a team of 2 or 3 of our guests. For our module on geochemistry's past, we're going to have Steve, Des, and Dave. For the present, we're going to have Michelle and Mike. And for the future, we're going to have Bucha, Kim, and Heidi. Because our panel here is diverse with such rich experience, I'm going to permit one person from each team to be able to say steal into somebody else's question and into their other module. So that way, if they have something that they really have to say, they're allowed to say it, but also kind of to save us on time at the same point. Okay, so that's it for the rules. Let's get into these modules. I hope that everybody listening enjoys what's about to happen, because honestly, I have no idea if this idea that was born in a bar at SCG in London is a good idea or it's going to be a disaster. But my commitment to this loyalty crew of mine is that it will be published as always, with very little editing. Okay, starting with the past. To remind everybody, this is going to be Steve, Des, and Dave. My first question here for everybody is, what was some of the most important research that was worked on in the past that has really laid the groundwork for modern day exploration geochemistry?
I'll probably dive in first, and I'll probably extend that to include the word technology. But from an Australian point of view, working in weathered terrains, regolith research for exploration geochemistry is probably far and away the most important thing that's probably happened in my lifetime, and understanding element dispersion, both primary and secondary. But coupled with that is technology and really the advent of ICP, multi-element chemistry, or be able to do multiple elements beyond the standard eight as we used to do in the day, and computers. Without all of those came together to sort of give us big data sets that we can handle efficiently.
People need to remember here when Suggs started out, he was using an abacus.
No, when I started out, that's a log probability graph pad. You have to plot your probability plots by hand.
Yeah, I tend to agree with what Suggs was saying, that not so much the geochemistry side, but certainly in the chem side, the plunge in detection limits because of the analytical technology that's continued through the past sort of 30 years. I mean, it was, what, about 70 years ago that we started off with AIS, and everybody was rapt to be able to get numbers from an AIS. Now we're looking at probably detection limits that are 1,000 or 100,000 times lower than what you could get on the AIS. And I think that has to have made a huge difference to what comes out with the geochem modules.
Agreed, Des, that ability to see true background. And now I'm seeing data sets, particularly the ultrafine soils, where I don't see any samples below or elements below detection limit. I'm seeing the pure dynamic range for the first time ever, which I've never seen before.
Geez, I wasn't expecting such a rational response. That's really good. And Sam, I'll just finish that off with the olden days was you got to go back to pre-IO gas, right? And so if you're given a bunch of geochemical data to look at, you're probably using, well, the dreaded Excel data desk, which was a good bit of kit, but not really optimized for geochemical data. ER-Mapper in the day, Dimple was another imaging thing, which wasn't too bad. And a whole pile of other stuff, right? To do one bit of geochemical work, you probably needed to open 6 different bits of software, none of which was optimized for it. And that was a pain in the neck, of course. But also go back to some of the earlier academics as well that certainly people in this group have interacted with over the years were really quite influential on what IO did in the geochemical work. So even pre-IO, I did a lot of work with Cliff Stanley, for example, so did Mike Whitbread, which really, in a way that launched, when it was appropriate, IO into doing a lot of litho geochemistry. And of course, a lot of that work to this day influences what is in IO GAD. Early interactions with Steve Walters as well, as if he ever listens to this, because, oh my God, I've had some excellent gossip about that, but I won't say it on here. And latterly, people like Kurt Kaiser, who's sadly no longer with us, was very, very inspirational and influential on a lot of the stuff that was going on in IO in the day. And just the other thing to remember is the other people that you interact with with the industry along the way, especially to the younger people listening. Younger, here we go. Listening to this, those people that you meet that have experience and can mentor you in the early phases of your career, if you get that chance, then you should really take full advantage of it, because it's not replaceable. You should listen and learn and take advantage and ask questions. People just starting out in this field, any field really, I'd recommend that they really do that. There's not enough of it in our industry now, actually. That's a problem.
Yeah, and I agree. One of the principles underlying the founding of this podcast was just the hope that I could make people that I know that have good ideas, seen a lot of things, by introducing them, introducing their stories to the masses. Maybe somebody out there that meets them at a conference is just like, oh, hey, I have a question. And maybe that develops into something. But it's kind of hard to approach, you know, somebody as famous as any of the people that I have sitting on the show right now when you just really don't feel like you have that in because you don't know them. I find all these answers really interesting. And I wasn't actually thinking in terms of, when I wrote the question, I was thinking more in terms of just baseline geochem first principles. I wasn't thinking about the technology aspect. And I find that so fascinating. And that kind of ties in talking about into my next question was, what was the role of a geochemist in a mining company before we had this 48 element data that would, that now we take for granted as almost routine?
I'd probably step in and take a step back from Dave's beginning and go back to the Archean, which applies to this question. And when I started, one of my first jobs as a graduate geologist in the early 80s, was sitting down with a multi-element data set of 8 elements. And this was in diamond exploration. And
it sucks. 8.
8. But that was a big multi-element data set in those days. It was assayed by AAS and AcquaRegia and XRF, early generation. And it was this 200 samples. And this was when an IBM PC was sort of just released. So everything was done manually. And I had 200 samples. I had a calculator and I had two graph pads, one for plotting the samples out in spatially, and the other one, which I've still got a book of, is log probability graph paper. And those were your tools. And so you wanted to work out an average, you had to enter the numbers in 200 times into your calculator and then divide by 200 and hope you got it right.
Is that real?
So that, I suppose, there's always been a role for geochemists. It's just the time factor of crunching data. Now, the next revelation was the development of the mini computers and digital technology, or DEC, some of the older people might remember. And I was working with CRA, and they had PDP 11s at most offices, and they'd purchased this program called GASP, Geochemical Analysis Statistical Package. And then they also bought a medical package called BMD, which had things like discriminant analysis in it back in the day. And you still had to hand enter your bloody data, typing it into a VT100 terminal. But provided you got that right, this thing would go away and do all these fabulous things, you know, including plotting your samples out on a sheet of A0 paper. But yeah, that was the world before multi-element chemistry. And I suppose the fact IC technology came out in the late 80s, and suddenly we were playing with 20 to 30 elements. Detection limits were still high, but coupled with that was the advent of the personal computer. And I used to use a package called StatView and also Datadesk on PCs and Macs. And that allowed you to look at the data, you know, multiple elements very quickly. And then IO Gas has refined that exceedingly well. And a routine data set is, look, 48 elements. I'm seeing typically 60 elements now because everybody's doing rare earths routinely. And when you get that with up to 10, 15,000 samples, you can do a hell of a lot more, but you've got the technology to make it quick, whereas the old days you couldn't do it. And I think, Mike, you managed to bust gas all the time with the size of data sets.
Oh, won't get on that bandwagon just yet. I'll save the whinging for later.
Just to put a little perspective on the advancement in technology, I did my chemistry in the dark old days of 1971 to 1973. And we actually had a calculator laboratory in the maths department where we used to go and do our assignments. There were no such things as computers at Curtin University or WA Institute of Technology at that stage. So we did all of our assignments and whatever on desktop calculators that were chained to the desk.
I am dying here. I'm afraid to ask. Dave, please.
What?
Oh my God, I'm just, My face is pale from all these stories. Oh my goodness.
There's more though. There's prehistoric stuff.
I was expecting to talk about colorimetry
and, you know, going out into the bush with a bottle of HCl and some reagents and then looking at how pink your solution in the tube was to guesstimate the amount of nickel in the soil or the pan clump or whatever.
The H types, and yeah, we also used to carry chemicals to sort of do stain tests. I remember I had to stare a geologist down in PNG, a mutual colleague that Dave went uni with, when he said, "Oh, I want to get some HF up onto site to do a Felsmouth stain test." And I said, "Not in your life," having come out of the diamond world. And but yeah, some of the chemicals you carried in those days, people, you know, were crazy, seriously dangerous. But we used to do those. I used to carry a multimeter and do a sort of SP test or spontaneous potential for basic geophysics. And the other thing we did was orientation programs in those days, because detection limits were so high. The orientation program was trying to find the fraction of the sample that had the most metal in it so you could get above the dam detection limit. And explaining that to people today is, you know, an orientation program, it has a totally different meaning to why we did it back in the old days.
I think, Sam, just adding to what Sam was saying there, in the olden days as a geochemist, one got involved in actually designing big sampling programs, and the most effective way of doing them be them soils, lags, stream sediments, rock chips, biogeochemical samples, whatever. And that was a key thing. And it was also key training people how to go out and collect representative samples, which would normally go badly wrong in every single program. But nevertheless, we tried to train people to, and it's actually ridiculous when I think about it now, but identify soil horizons and pick and sample particular soil horizons. You know, what could possibly go wrong? Well, typically everything in a program like that, to the point where the source of variance in the data had more to do with the shit sampling than anything to do with the chemistry of the signal that you were seeking. And certainly in our days, our global, we used to get lots of consulting work with people who had gone out conducting these big programs and had effectively wasted somewhere between $250,000 and up to $3 million with completely and utter shit sampling strategies, which nullified any potential benefit they could have gotten from those surveys, including people who shall remain nameless, who would go out to conduct very large lists of geochemical studies and analyze all of their drill core pulps with aquaresia rather than at least.
We're not touching that right now. We're not touching that.
PTSD. Fucking wanting to look for sodium alteration in bloody silicate minerals and things. Just look at them and go, well, yeah, we'll take your bloody money, but the data's shit. But we'll take your money and explain how shit it is to you in 2 months from now.
It happens today, Dave. I had a job at the beginning of the year, 3,500 soil samples. They wanted to explore for rare earths. They did it by aquaregia because somebody told them they needed boron.
What the
they
fuck?
They got told, sorry.
Oh,
no. What the hell? That's great.
Well, I told them, your data's shit, but I'll do what I can. Did what I could, and well, I don't think they were happy with the result. I haven't seen them since, but it was they did bless
tags that could just poof turn the crap into gold.
Oh. I would say, as the me being the ghost of geochemistry, past, present, and future, yeah. I'm going to jump to present real quick and bring in our representative from the mining industry sitting here. We're not going to call him Huge here. We're going to call him Mike and just ask him, because I think we painted a very interesting picture of what the geochemists of the past did. And I'm just so curious, what is a geochemist sitting in a mining company doing currently that is maybe the same and maybe very different? I can transverse boundaries like that. So,
yeah, well. I did write some things down here to try not to butt into that previous conversation and add a diatribe to it. But we're still fighting the same battles in many respects, right? So We've got a lot of data coming in from a lot of pretty fancy looking instruments, right? You can look at microanalytical type work as an example of something that we never had before, that we can now look at the chemistry of individual grains, and people really get into that. And that's where a lot of our new geochemists that we're training up come from. They do a PhD or an MSc or something analytically orientated, but they don't actually understand that it's all a waste of time if the sample is not the correct one in the first place. And so we're really struggling with this lack of knowledge in our younger geoscientists, because our older guys took inside the company. I mean, now there's a lot of, you know, old CRA hands who got very, very good training, right? They got trained in everything, sample theory, stats, you know, and that's why they felt they didn't need geochemists for a long time, because they all were geochemists partially. But now we've got the situation where young geologists, their university degrees are pretty awful, to be honest, in terms of the fundamental training they receive in that. And where we have to really try and get them to think about, well, you know, that you did a soil survey, you're planning one. Do you know which bits are residual or erosional or depositional? It's a very simple thing. And most people don't even know what you're talking about. Right? So even though we had two CRCs for landscape evolution go through this country previously. So there's a real gap there where we do need some training for the industry just generally. Look, in a big company, it's easy, right? We've got resources. We train our people internally. We do workshops like the IO Global ones. I think I've even tried to raid slides out of Michelle a few times in the past in various companies I've been in to use as training material, because it just saves you time. But now we have to condense that down to from 5 days to 2 half-day sessions, right? Because everyone's too busy. And you can imagine how much of that goes in. But what it usually does, allows you to identify the ones with the spark who are going to at least be curious about the problems that you show them, and then you work with them. And so, you know, the current job for a geochemist is kind of trying to hold everyone accountable for good fundamental science, right? It's like collect the right kind of sample, get the right kind of assay, look at the data the right kind of way. And it's why it's a fun job, right? Because you never know which element of that is going to be the problem that arises in your inbox. It just depends on the capabilities of the people in various teams and what they're looking at. And we are now going back increasingly, now that there's a bit of a lithium game going on, right? We're taking more surface samples again. It's not just drilling through cover. So these fundamental approaches are becoming, the past is also the present in many respects, if I can use that paradigm.
Okay, I think we'll just keep pushing this forward. And I really like how we were able to juxtapose those two things. I didn't intend for it, but it just was too good of a situation not to do it. Heading back to the past now, I think we've touched on this multiple times already, whether it be in the tea session or when we first even started with just introductions. Do you see value then in having consultancy like IO Global to service the mineral exploration and mining industries? And really to that point, it's something like this, do you feel even required to continue to drive geochemistry forward?
Short answer, yes. But I suppose the issue it runs into is managing a big consultancy. And what I see from my perspective dealing with a range of companies from sort of mid-tier through to the junior end is the large consultancies probably not as efficient as they used to be. And particularly as soon as they become publicly listed, their focus changes. But yeah, the issue or problem I always find with as a sole practitioner now is sort of trying to keep your knowledge up. And the real benefit of IO Global is having this group of people plus a few others in the room. And one war story was one day I was looking at a set of data from a company that's been mentioned a lot, and I couldn't figure out what the hell was wrong because I knew the area intimately and existing deposits weren't showing up. And at the coffee machine, I was talking to Michelle, and Michelle said, oh yeah, what about Excel and not ticking the actual cell value? They forgot to tick that box. And yes, that was right. They'd gone through and replaced zero, but they turned 406 ppm into 46 ppm.
Sure.
But that conversation around a coffee machine, you don't get if you're working by yourself or in a small group of two people. And I see a lot of people avoid big companies now because probably the big killer is cost. The overheads of a big company now getting more and more, and typically, you know, if I was in a big company, I might charge out rate to be double what I'm doing now to cover all the other mouths. It was the same in IO Global. When you have receptionists, accountants, bookkeepers, etc., PIs and the PL insurances, the costs add up.
And a wine cellar to keep.
Oh, my God.
Yes, mate.
Yep.
Yeah, that Mosswood Cabernet is not cheap. You know, you've got to look after that.
Sorry, Dave. I'll let you come back on there.
Do you remember the IO wine with the periodic table labels? There you go.
I still have some downstairs.
I don't think it would have salad well, so.
Those
wines were not Mosswood Cabernets. They were some clean skin you could buy for almost nothing and slap an IO Global label on it. They certainly wouldn't have lasted this long.
It's leaving to do now. Unless it comes from the winery.
Hold on, we got to steal. Heidi's going to steal.
You were talking about, you know, is there value in having IO Global version 2? And I think something we haven't touched on yet that's quite important, and when the short answer would be yes, but I think there's a lot going on in the tech and the academic space, and probably people don't, or maybe some of your listeners might not appreciate the difference between, well, first of all, the huge range of geochemists that exist, but as well, the difference between an applied geochemist versus someone who's in academia versus someone who's maybe got a foot in both worlds, such as CSIRO or here in Australia. That was one of the things that IO Global did try to do, I think, particularly with through our teachings and the course material and stuff, was actually try and bring some of those things that academia was or the research industry was coming up with, whether it be just diagrams or latest ideas through PhDs and things like that, it bring them into industry. Because at the end of the day, I think that's our common thread here anyways, is that, you know, we're applied geochemists, and apologies if others don't agree with that label, but there's a real big difference. There's so much amazing work being done. But at the end of the day, if we can't apply that in a commercial sense at a mine site, which usually involves a certain cost and a certain turnaround time, then, you know, some of the great work that's being done in the research and academic space, you know, isn't going to see the light of day, which is a shame. But I think that there's a bridge there that is still needed. And I don't know, Michelle, you've said before, when IO Global Geochemistry was up and running, we were perhaps one of the largest groups of geochemists working together at the time. But I think that there's, for myself anyways, I can say that since I left IO Global, I haven't had that experience of people trying to create that bridge between the research that's being done and the application in industry, which we always need. Industry is always, it's a double-edged sword. Industry wants all the innovation, but they want it yesterday and they want it for cheap. So how do you make that happen?
I love that. That was a great steal. Anybody else have something to add before we take a jump to the present? Okay. And I'll remind
you. I loved listening to that. That was great.
All right. So our present team here is made of Michelle and Mike. These questions can be a little futuristic too, but let's try and stay focused on the present, but it's okay if we dabble into the future. Okay. So my first question is, currently, how are people treating their geochemical data? Even though we collect 48 or 60 elements worth of data, are we moving beyond just using ore elements? And if not, how do we continue to instill this change that there's more to life than just your copper assay or your gold assay? The other elements have meaning.
Mike, I feel like you've already started answering this question a bit where, you know, and I see a bunch of people trying to do, the people I suspect that might use multi-element data these days choose to call themselves data scientists rather than geochemists. And how do you bridge this gap between data scientists? I mean, you know, lots of geochemists are really data scientists. And Mike, I'm guessing that depending on the day, you might call yourself one or the other, which is completely fair. But I think your point around how do we make sure that the fundamentals of geochemistry don't get lost in there is as valid for geochem as it is for the rest of the geosciences. This is a really common conversation across lots of these fields.
Yeah, look, data science one's a good example where we have people who have no idea what a rocket is, right? They've got absolutely no idea. And the job for the geochemist in that situation becomes a boundary spanning role. You're trying to talk all the languages to different people and you sort of sit in the middle of it. So, you know, I think we're going all right in terms of, well, certainly in the larger companies that I've been involved with recently, they now understand that they need to make use of more than what they, you know, have in the past in terms of the element suite, if nothing else. We're starting to find that people are piling on to the ore body knowledge bandwagon. And that's actually made it a lot easier for us to start leveraging elsewhere in the value chain, if I can use those words, to use everything. We start collecting all the data from the start, right? So we commonly getting the same data sets from the early exploration phase through to the resource drilling. Once they're sort of grade control, it tends to drop off again, of course, because it's a different problem. But ore body knowledge has become a big driver for us to leave the gap open and say, look, you guys really need to pay attention to this from the start. If you want to build a mine now, we found one recently, right? But if you want to build a mine, you've got to actually plan the closure before you're allowed to start mining it, right? And so suddenly you actually have to have carbon assays, right? But no one wants to pay for those. So how do you work out where you need to get it? And this is where machine learning and everything starts to come in with people trying to go, well, we can do FTIR on this, or we, and then use the geochem trained on that and then predict this and then assay for that. And then that's the present state where we don't really know how that's all going to play out. But it doesn't seem to be at our end of town, doesn't seem to be as big a problem. But I still get cold calls from people who I know previously through other lives, and they go, can you just give me some advice for free about what I should be doing? And I say, for God's sake, just go talk to one of the consulting people that might be on this call. Because they're still trying to do things on the cheap, or they get sold partial ledge surveys. They still get sold, believe it or not. So, Eddie, it's like financial advice. Go talk to someone who knows what they're doing.
Talk to a professional.
Yeah, and there is elements of that, but a lot of the people who still think about AI is the geochem sort of tool of choice, they're sort of moved on now, and I think we're facing different issues. I don't know if you think that's fair, Michelle.
Yeah, I do. And I don't know, Sam, whether this is the next place you're going to go anyway, but there's obviously multi-element geochemistry, but machines that go ping are really starting to become more and more a feature of our lives, which I think adds to the data richness at the front and exacerbates a lot of the problems that we just talked about. I don't know how many people are keeping track of the number of different scanning systems in the market now, but it must be getting close to 20, all with really different use cases and applications, and people's understanding about what we do with all of those and dealing with all of that data just makes all of this getting really complex, actually.
And actually, Michelle, my third question of the segment, but we'll move it up one because it just flows so naturally. Because we do have a lot of these different scanning systems now. Some allegedly do the same thing, but don't. So I guess what I'm looking for here and then within this question is, what are your feelings on some of these available technologies for both geochem and mineralogy, which is very related to geochemistry? And also, where do we need to go? Kind of how do we make these systems, which are always going to be different, but especially the ones that are supposed to be very similar, how do we make them talk to each other?
Yeah, man. Okay.
Deep question. Deep.
Sorry, man.
Another hour.
That's right. I'll put aside some of them. There's plenty of geochemists purists on the call. I'm definitely one of them. So maybe I'll get out there that all of us, I think, still have a degree of frustration sometimes at seeing some of these things being used, knowing that they're superficial scanning technologies and people not understanding the difference between that and true representative geochemistry. So set it now, feel a little bit better. That's definitely a little bit of my geochemistry.
We're all putting hands up in the video. We see, we hear you. Okay, yeah. You said it.
Yeah, exactly. But look, I think it's going to be part of our future now. So the question's got to be, how do people start realizing, there's not going to be one of these scanners that solves all of the world's problems. They all do have really different use cases. How do we get educated enough to know what they are? And then, to your point, how do we start being able to treat those data streams in our systems so that you can use two of these technologies in parallel if you want to? Now, again, I know this is actually part of Mike's lived day-to-day now that we are one of the companies that are trying to find ways to do this. But I reckon in terms of the problem that I get asked whether IMDEX is going to solve, this is probably the most common one that people come up and say, you know, is someone going to do something here? We've got all of this data. It's not talking to each other. Everyone's doing an amazing job within their ecosystem to make sense of what that scanner means. But how do we integrate it with all the other data that we've got?
Yeah, I'll second that one. Data integration, big problem. But there is a second element to the scanning, a game that I guess is I've only recently sort of become aware of, isn't that there's not enough of those instruments about, actually. We're finding that you could probably get a use case going for an advanced project, but early stage exploration where we want some data scanned in the middle of nowhere, I was nearly going to use inappropriate language there, but we're in the middle of nowhere. You can't get a scanning system out there and operate it in the middle of the desert and, you know, 9 hours bumpy drive from the nearest airport or whatever. But so what's going to be the nature of the game in collecting that information? Do we start looking at bringing materials back to a central processing facility? Now, there's issues with that, you know, because you may juggle all the core up on the way back in the back of the year. There's so many unknown problems, unknown answers, you know, around that. And I don't quite know how it's going to be resolved. Yeah. And remember thermal, which is really important in the scanning tech, we want thermal data as well as shortwave, infrared and micro-X-ray if you can get it. You want everything, honestly, but they're missile technology sensors, right? And so they're never going to get cheaper at the moment, given the world situation. So I know how valuable these things really are.
Yeah, I reckon that digital core farm versus the lab versus the rig dynamic, lots of room to go before we really figure out where we're going to apply them in the value chain. That's definitely something we talk about lots. And I think too, the cold hard reality of, you know, we've talked a bit in the past about the fact that people are unwilling to pay for more than 8 elements. The reality is to pay for scanning data to truly scan all of your core at the rates that those units can scan, that's a sort of another layer up in terms of spend. And so, you know, it's a shift for the industry to really realize. But to Mike's point, if we all believe some of our own rhetoric around all body knowledge, how much of this do we just have to do?
Yeah, and I think I would add my own opinion there, even as the ghost of chemistry, past, present, and future, would be that I think we also have to hold our vendors to very high standards. And for that, it's very hard because there aren't many people out there that know the ins and outs of all these different technologies to know enough to say, this is how you have to be collecting it. And until you collect it this way, I won't employ you. I won't let you process my data, et cetera, because there is this piece right now where there's this big gap and where even I find some of the vendors don't understand their technology well enough.
Yeah, so QA reporter for scanners, Des. There's a definite window of opportunity there.
Window of opportunity, Des. We can talk about this together.
Yeah, look,
I've actually come up with a term for this just the past week, which Dave will like because it's very dorky. But it's dust control, and dust is not about fine particulates, but it's about the dumb use of smart technology. So,
but it could also be for dust.
Dust stands for the dumb use of smart technology. There's so much smart tech out there, and it's used in so many dumb ways that we really need the people who understand how it all works and what the application is to undo some of that. And this goes not just for people who are uneducated. There are also what Michelle just said. There's data scientists out there who think they can, and this company shall remain unnamed. I've had some interactions with them where they say, we don't need all the geo nonsense. We just come in with the data science and we solve all the problems of exploration and find the next, whatever, nickel mine.
I'll just say, Pim, that kind of...
I believe they've just purchased one, but never mind. They also, you know, men realized over the past couple of years that they have to hire a lot of geos to really help them understand the data, which is testament to what we talked about earlier. We need people to understand the ins and outs of the tech as well as the application.
Yeah. That's my next job, pulling apart the sins of data science and getting back to a real story for them, because they ended up down the rabbit hole. my perspective is a lot of this data is coming out, particularly hyperspectral data, but clients come to me with it and they say, well, what do I do with it? And there's no knowledge. In the old days, IO Global, we did geochemistry training to show them what they could do with 48 elements. And it's one of the disappointments is there's almost a need for somebody to sit down and write a basic hyperspectral scanning 101 textbook, for example.
I can help.
Your hands up there, Sam.
if you need help, I can help.
Oh, no. And look, for the IMDEX world, being able to sort of put out more technical information to help people understand, or any other technology company, how to use your technology. And it crashes into the IP world as well. A lot of companies I see with the machines that go ping won't tell you very much because they're fearful of giving away their...
Yeah, and so completely to this point, and I think I'm fine right now with the no steals because this is such a great conversation, but really... My last question in this module, we've already been talking to and talking around and talking at, but it is just this, like talking about machine learning or AI with geochem, mineralogical, hyperspectral, whatever kind of data. As we know, these types of data sets can be perilous, historic data sets in particular. But now we're also talking about some things that have some problems in the QA/QC of all of it through the different stages of collection. So really, what here is our concern for data cleaning? And are we at the point where we can just blindly trust any algorithm to just, as you so lovely say, go ping, and it's going to give us never. Something that's a real analysis or something?
No.
Never. Another one of these secret sources of IO Global things is we actually had a really structured way. We ran a job. Every job had to be run the same. You know, the guys will all start nodding because this is really what my job was mostly, was to keep them honest that we ran our jobs this way, right? Where data comes in, first thing you do is you look at that data and you clean it up and you make sure it knows what it means. But usually the most difficult conversation we ever had to have with the people that we did work for is we might spend 5 days cleaning your data and 2 days making sense of it at the end. And that's just the brutal reality. And that hasn't changed, right? Nothing we're talking about here around technology and data science changes that fundamental need to actually be able to guarantee the quality of your data. And actually, if you talk about, you know, some of the reasons that Dave and I do and stuff that we do in IMDEX and our focus on sensor data and things like that is to allow as much as you can automating that QA, because it's so important that the data you do data science on the back on is clean. And so what are ways that you can make sure you can do that?
Not just the data cleanup though, right? It's also the confidence in the interpretation ultimately, right? And I know it sort of melds with roles of the future, geochemist, geologist, geoscientist though. It's like ultimately, you know, all the numbers look the same in an Excel spreadsheet, but you put shit in, you get shit out, right? So how do you make sure that the stuff that comes out is actually worthy of interpretation? And I think there's a hole there. I think we've alluded to this about perhaps current data scientists and also Sam, you know, application of machine learning and AI is you have to put it back into a geological context. If it doesn't make sense, you can't explain the processes, whether they be the desired ones or the undesired ones, then you actually have no validity around, you know, your ore body knowledge or the interpretations or the correlations that are being pulled out, however you want to call it. I think there's a misconception that, you know, the algorithms and the machine learning are a shortcut and they'll come out with something. But if the data's biased, then so will the outcomes. And if you don't know that, if you don't have a skilled eye to look at and see what could potentially be going wrong, both at the interp stage as well as the data cleaning stage, then all that work and all that time is for naught. And I think as we increase the amount of data that we have and perhaps not being enough geochemists or applied geochemists on the planet, there's some big capital decisions that could be being made, lots of money being spent without the actual understanding that, you know, just because an answer came out doesn't mean that it's actually a valuable answer. And to put that back into not only the value chain, but also the ore systems or the geology of it, I think is incredibly important. And you need a geoscientist to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, hiding.
I guess one of the things that I always used to sort of tell people about laboratories is that if you don't get your sample prep right, you can't unstuff that sample any other way. It's very much the same with data. If you've got crap data coming in, there is no way that you can process that data to get anything realistic coming or anything decent coming out. And I think that's probably the most important point that we have to look at, is to ensure that the data is good and as good as you can get.
Mike, did you have something that you wanted to add to this? You raised your hand so politely.
Yeah, I've been trying to cut in for a while, but these guys, you know, they talk and talk.
No, look, talk and talk, you know, but it is your show. You are part of the present team. So
apparently. Now, but one thing we keep running up against, right, and this is where I think, you know, in the present, I think companies have to work out what they want, you know, is the companies that are trying to bring new systems into play, really, you know, we've been in a small company called IO, and if we're in there from the beginning, you could see how hard it is to get a company up and running and making money. And these technology companies have only got a limited window to get going as well. And so if you don't support them in that process, they're not going to be able to give you the QA and the QC and the tools and the visualization capability that you might need to actually get good value out of the product. And typically, the mining industry has been a terribly fickle customer for any of the tech groups. And we're not even that big a client base, really, for these people. So sometimes our expectations around what we need before we'll adopt something are not quite right. So some companies, it's not just ours, are looking at co-funding arrangements, which I think is a good way to try and see people across that hurdle. But you have to have a bit of faith, and that's pretty hard sometimes to justify internally in terms of a business case, right? But you know, the scanning providers, if we go back to them for a minute, whether it's micro scanning or core scanning or whatever, they just need to get some scale and market going so they can be profitable. And I think what we're seeing, this tension between some of the things that are coming out and they're putting out as case studies, is because they just need to get the word out and they don't really care. It's a little bit of snake oil because they won't survive otherwise. So it's a conundrum for the industry, and our role in there as well is to sort of help try and bridge that divide, I think. Anyway.
Yeah. As somebody that formerly used to try and sell scanning technology, it's a tricky situation for sure. But I think we're also seeing large companies investing in these scanning technologies, and hopefully that funding then gets more units on the marketplace and et cetera, et cetera.
But you're going to have to pay more. You're going to have to pay more. It always, okay. Someone's got to pay in the end. So if you want the quality, you got to pay. And we look, to be honest, we're not seeing a lot of pushback around the assaying side of things, really, I think, these days. Even in some juniors, okay, you do see it. Land access is usually the biggest cost, you know, for large companies trying to explore. So the last in cost, which is the assaying, it's usually not the argument, but it's when you start wanting to scan and assay and maybe do a spectrum on the pulp, and you kind of go, well, that's all starting to add up. We'll be faced with some interesting choices about, do we actually not assay sometimes and do something else that we can do more consistently? And that's probably coming at us. Maybe I'll leave that for the future team to comment on.
Yeah. That said, I think that's a really great segue into the future. This team is comprised of Putra, Pim, and Heidi. And as we said before, anybody can steal in. We had a lot of cross-pollination in this one, but I think it went really well, and I wasn't too upset about it.
Let's start this one. Yeah. Yeah, I can start this one, Sam. I'm too keen, but my ears have sort of been burning.
You think? So a couple of things, right? So one of it is really just the future of the profession. I'm probably the youngest here. Sorry, guys. Anyway. But, you know, when I did my MSc in geochemistry, you know, they taught us a lot about isotope geochem, but not a lot about what the geochemistry actually means in the context of exploration or resource development. So and that's something that we still see these days, right? So, you know, a decade or more after I finished uni. It's something that I still see, that you don't tie in the actual work that you do with the geochem with the end result. And Heidi was right. You need to tie it back to the context of the geology, but also to the audience of the people that you're
ultimately making this interpretation for. So for example, if you're doing an exploration geochemistry interp, some of this will go towards the process of generating targets and defining your resource. So you got to remember the end audience of it. So people in the C-suite and things like that. So the context of what you do, you need to put some sort of value to the work that you do in terms of the geochem. So assigning value to the knowledge that you create from this work. And I think there's a disjoint there that I don't think geochemists in general, they're not that proficient enough to put the value of their work they're doing in terms of the dollar value of how it impacts the development of a mine and that sort of thing. Because if you think of geochemistry, you know, you think of assay values that get reported in a stock exchange report, but you don't see a Hallberg diagram or a Wohler element ratio plot being used in a stock exchange report, but you put it in the context of you use geochem to validate some of the loggings, things like that. And just my 2 cents.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point about the envision of the future of the geochemist. Heidi or Pim, do you have any thoughts to add to that?
Once you jump in there, Pim, I'm sure you've got a few burning thoughts.
I've got all kinds of thoughts. One of the things is that I see that as much as we need to understand technology and understand our data, where it came from, how it was generated, you know, the methods that went into it to be able to interpret it, we also need to learn the tools to interpret it. And that's what's happening now a lot. And we've already mentioned, we touched on data science, you know, Mike's using a lot, like my team is also using a lot, but it's still the toolbox is not even understood and it's developing very, very rapidly. So the tools that are available to us to actually do smart stuff with good data, you know, I think that's a very exciting future for geochemistry. And that's where we will need a lot more capable geochemists that we don't have. So there's a real big problem there, but at the same time, also a real big excitement, I find. And the other piece is the Starbucks conundrum of the scanning technology and all the pieces of kit that are out there where, you know, Starbucks started off as a coffee company and now they sell, I don't know, 500 different products. Most of them are not coffee anymore. So yeah, are they still a coffee company, right?
I had a pumpkin spice latte today, so.
There you go. Was there even any caffeine in it? Point is, you know, there's so much out there. It will have to consolidate in some respects, and we will need to really let the smarts prevail there. And I think that will happen. And to Putra's earlier point about, you know, for people to understand what's happening, Mike also mentioned this, you know, how do you communicate this? I think one of the things that we suffer from now is sort of the junior exploration company that's so dependent on cowboy venture capital that competes with NFTs and crypto and weed that, you know, you're talking to the wrong investors there, right? But what we see happening actually with our group, but also across the board, you can see this is that now end users are starting to get more worried about supply chains. So you see the car manufacturers coming into mining, right? And you see that I think that's a really interesting trend because these are people with deep pockets, with long-term incentives. They want to make sure to secure their supply chains throughout the mining value chain. And I think that's where material characterization for us as geochemists is going to be critical, right? Understanding the ore body itself, but also how is it going to be processed? What are you going to leave behind? How do you do it with a minimal footprint? And all that, as Mike mentioned, you need to predict and simulate closure before you even open the mine. So I think there's a huge potential there. We have the tools, we have the technology, we just don't have the people to actually piece it all.
I think that there's, the future is bright, yeah, is what I would say, you know, for geoscientists in general, but particularly for geochemists as well. I mean, if we grab the theory about, you know, our future is going to be 40 times more mineral and metal intense with the green energy and the convergent electric future and whatnot, I think there's nothing that we can't be happy about in that space and how to do that more sustainably as well. But I think one of the things that I'm particularly excited about for the future and the future role of the geochemist is, and it kind of comes in line with the scanning technology, but all of our traditionally, and I'd say most of the geochemistry that's done in the present, we collect samples, be they ad hoc or be they carefully thought out. Some companies do meter on meter regular sampling with the full assay suite, which is sort of the applied geochemist dream. But now with the scanning technology, of course, there's pros and cons, but I think something that is a low-hanging fruit is that's going to be huge, that is a huge paradigm shift, is we're moving to continuous data collection, right? There's no longer this geologist discretion or a bias, say, in picking the shiniest sample or the one that looks like X, Y, or Z. So I think there's a huge amount of low-hanging fruit that's going to come out of having continuous data. And yeah, I hope I see that in my career time. I think once the light bulb, you know, goes on, the penny drops, and companies see that there is a huge amount of value in collecting data. I think, Mike, you mentioned this, you know, from the beginning and all the different silos using the same data set that was consistently collected with a modern technology. You know, it's for myself, I think that's really exciting. I think it will ultimately completely change how exploration and mining and the entire value chain is done. And also we'll see a huge amount of efficiencies that are generated and hopefully a breakdown of the silos that we often have across the mining value chain. I think it does, the scanning obviously does lead to machine learning and it will sort that all out. But a lot of the old issues we have with traditional geochemistry, I think it will be, they'll be replaced by others, of course. But there's, yeah, I hope I've been able to work on a project that from beginning to end where all the core is scanned. And I just think about modeling that and the advantages of how we can domain that and understand our ore body knowledge will be completely, it'll be a completely different playing field, if you will. So I don't see that end up.
I do see that, but just really quick, just to comment on that, Heidi, I think one thing that you said about being able to model all this data, nobody wants to talk about it, at least not on the show, but I've seen so many data sets now where we have so much core that's been scanned, hyperspectral, XRF, and it's just the actual modeling of it is a huge burden and huge challenge that I really believe takes a think tank. So maybe the IAGS 2024, we have like a think tank session and how we're going to start doing this and maybe put something in place for it, because it's really, it's a combination of so new, it's so different, I think. I think all of our expertises are in different areas, but when amalgamated, we could probably figure out how to do this together. So that's going to be my little thing I'll put for the group and for who is ever listening. Steve, what did you want to say?
Okay. I suppose two things. I totally agree with Heidi, and I divide the future into sort of quantification, and that's modeling and taking the data, scanning core. And I believe by the time I sort of become fertilized, that a lot of the routine tasks like core logging and all of that will be automated. The other side is prediction. And this is where we're at the dawn of machine learning. And I've seen a number of, I think, Oz Minerals in threw their data out and got people to try and predict from their data where deposits is. And that one I'm not so sure about, because exploration, we live in a data deficient world. We're not in a mining operation where we have high data density. And we also live in a world where failure is the norm. You know, 99 out of 100 exploration programs would be lucky to find anything. And how we manage to be able to improve our predictive ability, given the fact we haven't got the data in the first place in exploration, is a challenge.
Kuchar, what did you want to say?
Just jumping off the back of some of the people's points today, we will always need geochemists to validate data that comes from, you know, the result of applying a machine learning model to a training data set, for example, right? So we'll always need a subject matter expert to validate predictions and things like that. But we also need sort of geochemists to communicate the value of collecting the data still. I don't see a future where people will stop sending data to the lab for analysis, right? Just to get that detail. But I do see a future where, this is probably blasphemous coming from me, but I think probably within my lifetime, we probably wouldn't see desktop software anymore.
It needs to go on the cloud anyway, yeah. To be able to handle the large volumes of data we generate.
Yes.
Yeah, but who's going to make that software for us? You know, we're not actually a market for a software company. No one wants to write software for us.
Right. So now we're talking about the future, Mike. And when the industry is taken out by big oil, then there'll be the money to write that software.
Mm-hmm. A twist. Halliburton, they'll be writing our software.
Right. That is the future point, actually.
Big oil went there in the past.
They're energy now. Yeah. They're all energy companies.
They're all energy companies. You're right.
Over, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you're right, some sort of disruption, you know? We need some sort of disruption.
We are visualization.
Both, perhaps. You know, we've seen the 3D goggles, and we've also seen that there's the virtual reality rooms and the virtual reality tables. I think that because geologists, we work across many scales, both physically as well as in time. But I'm thinking more of the physical now, right? We need to be able to understand the micro, the macro, and the mega, and being able to have multiple people, whether they be in the same location or not, be able to say, you know, zoom in and zoom out of a mine using their own portable virtual reality table that projects all the scans, say, of a mine site. I think that when we circle back around to science communication, a lot of it is trying to understand and see what the other person sees through their eyes. And if we could take away that or augment, you know, add on to the human interaction things, and actually being able to see the scans themselves and see the rocks in 3D, not just in 2D and not just in a static 2D method. I think that software already exists.
And maybe also, and maybe this is me being very naive, maybe the step change of the quote energy companies getting involved is, from my understanding of these oil companies, these energy companies, their IP, they believe, is their people and not their data. So there's a lot of sharing of data in the oil industry, which I think has enriched them to make many more discoveries than we've seen in mining. So perhaps that is...
That's another show on data sharing.
It's another.
Another episode of geochemistry.
There we go. Oh, exactly. Yes. We are at a moment here where we have just gone on. It has been beautiful. I think if I could just ask one last question of you guys. I have a lot of young listeners out there, people early career, people that are still in school. And one thing that continue to ask about is just, even though we were talking about the future that we believe geochemistry has, is there a job for them? And how do they go through 5-10 years of schooling and just feel like, when I got out of school, I can be a geochemist? What are your thoughts? Mike.
I put my hand up. This is a topic I'm quite passionate about.
I love it. Me too.
And look, you know, it's really around them getting into, if they're going to do, we were talking about applied geochemistry in the exploration and mining game, right? So they've just got to get some experience as a geoscientist, I think, before they specialize. And you know, people are a little bit impatient that now, but you've got to go and see the rocks. You have to be that boundary spanner, right? You have to understand what the problems are. So you've got to try and, in your early career, particularly before family formation, get out and around and see as much as you can, and then move across if you're interested in data and what to do with it at that point. So that's my two cents. And I think we can, we're training our own up, right? Because we're picking these people out when they're in late 20s, early 30s, and they're often looking for a change in their role at that point. And it's really obvious who the right ones are to become the people to take up, people like myself, right? So I'm quite positive in larger companies that they've got the capability to train their own. So for people who are looking to get into the industry, I would argue, suggest look for a good work with good companies on a variety of rocks and problems, and then move across a bit later.
Pooja?
I approve that 100%, Mike.
So just echoing sort of Mike's comments, I agree with everything he said. And also I would like to add that, and this is in addition to my earlier point, is that I think knowing the geochemistry basics and learning to apply to your work is incredibly important, but also putting it into the context of the people that you're presenting your results to. There will come a point when these people will need to justify why they're doing that work. So putting it in dollar amount somehow, I think that's something that you can't really be taught at that school. But I guess my advice is just keep an open eye, you know, and the sort of opportunities that comes your way. There's a bit of a side way, you know, I did an MBA a couple of years ago, mostly because I was bored, but But look, it gave me an insight that when you're talking to people in the C-suite, for example, and I did a few of that when I was doing my MBA, it's like, when you did that, you got to learn how to communicate in a certain way, be convincing, and you just have to get straight to the point, right? So when you're presenting the result of a geochem interview, you got to put in the, why does it matter? That sort of thing. What's the why behind you doing it? That sort of thing.
I think that's a great way to end this show. And I just really cannot thank everybody enough for being here. So big thanks to Dave, Michelle, Pim, Heidi, Steve, Des. I want to thank everybody here, even though it was longer than usual, but beautiful. Oh, wait. Oh, Mike says, though, for everybody to know, in reference to our last point, that soft skills and communication is critical. So everybody should learn that as well.
Yeah, I don't think you have to do an MBA to get that. But but you can see Petra's spot on, right? Something I learned really far too late in my career was how to talk to people who are too busy. Right. How do you get the point? And good on you, Petra. Good point.
I think I can't even end the show. Here goes, Heidi.
It's made to come full circle, Sam. You know, it's about part of the reason for your show here is about inspiring and mentoring young people. And I think, you know, the value of a good network cannot be underrated. Ultimately, people like to hang out with people that they have fun with. And, you know, if you see us around at conferences and whatnot, we're just people too. We've all had the ups and downs and lateral moves and everything, and just come up and say hello. I think people are interested in sharing the good word and lending a hand most of the time. And maybe they don't have time at that particular moment, but offered to buy someone a coffee or a beer. A lot of business happens over coffees and beers. Maybe it used to be the campfire as well, but I would say, yeah, you know, we're all trying to do what we can. So definitely come up and say good day and sound more Australian than I do Canadian. But yeah, definitely repeat it for emphasis again. The power of a network cannot be overemphasized enough.
Dave, what did you have to add?
I've loved listening to this actually, but I think I get asked increasingly, actually, as time goes on, when you're putting the band back together. And I think people listening to this podcast can now understand why I get asked that very often, because there is a gap. We've left a hole in the geoscience world and it's not been quite filled yet.
Heard, Chef, heard. Oh my goodness. Anybody else wanted to say something? Okay. We're cutting your, I tried to say goodbye to you guys already. I'm not going to say your names again. I've said goodbye. I want to thank everybody for listening to Geochemistry. Big thanks to our guests for dishing some great tea, taking us on this Charles Dickens holiday style journey. I want to thank our sponsor, LKI Consulting, and to It's Water and Coma Media for our music. And I'm looking forward to chatting with everybody next month. So thank you.